in the insider trading case has distinct elements, and I would understand that court would make that ruling appropriate.
What's the bottom line? What's your bottom line position on Feinberg and Benton? Is it going to be extinguished by this settlement or not?
I would say not, again, with the limited knowledge I have of that case, which is not full.
Now you were going to say something about race judicata.
Yeah, you had raised an issue about the race judicata impact of the demutualization claim in another
context. Justice Jacobs asked that question.
I'm sorry, Justice Jacobs, excuse me. And I think what's significant here is that there was a case in which demutualization has been argued, and that was in a Pennsylvania state court, and on summary judgment that claim was dismissed at the time of the demutualization. So I think there's already a ruling in place that impacts on whether or not demutualization is even a viable claim in any jurisdiction. And I believe that was even raised in the federal district court cases. Now, as I mentioned, we
and do you have the cite to that Pennsylvania case?
No, but I can get that. As I mentioned, the settlement resolved the equitable claims we were seeking, which concern the breach of the charter claim of the Philadelphia Stock Exchange. And indeed, the very structure of the settlement that we've put together here reflects the nature of the rescissory relief that we had sought. At the settlement hearing, the Chancellor praised the settlement in light of the substantial risk that there would be no recovery in the case, as cited in the record at 446 to 456. The Chancellor observed, quote, "I've yet to see a more fiercely and intensely litigated case than this case. Never in 22 years have I seen counsel going at it hammer and tongue like they have gone at it in this case at A450.
I don't understand. What's the point of telling us that?
Well, I also wanted to point out to the court that the case was substantially litigated and was in front of the Chancellor, and he made numerous rulings on discovery as well as on class.
How does that touch on the appellant's arguments?
I'm sorry. That was really just background to get to the point of the degree of involvement of the Chancellor throughout the litigation and his familiarity with the facts and the class. Now, there's essentially two areas that the appellants have argued here today. One is on challenging class, and the groups are the certification appellants and the settlement appellants. Both arguments really focus on who gets the recovery rather than the quantum of the recovery. And the issues they've raised today are essentially allocation issues that the Chancellor has already indicated that are more properly to be heard at a subsequent hearing in front of him on the issue of allocation.
What about one issue I think is not about allocation but about the demutualization and whether that claim was part of your complaint? It's your complaint, right?
That's correct.
So were you stating a claim for some wrongdoing in connection with the demutualization, and if so, can you show me what paragraph?
Well, the demutualization was a factual predicate to our case, and it's cited in the record before the court at A180 through A184. It's also cited in the pre-stipulation filing of B1236. It was also a matter of substantial discovery.
You described it as a predicate. Is a predicate the same as an operative fact?
I think for this circumstance it is, and the Chancellor's ruling did examine whether the demutualization was a matter that was before the court throughout the litigation and ruled that it was an operative fact.
What is an operative fact?
I think it fits into a fact that affects the existing legal claims and relationship, and in this case the demutualization would be a predicate fact. In fact, the demutualization was the event from which the shares that are in dispute were created, as well as the certificate terms that were in dispute throughout this case. Now, I'm going to principally try to focus on the class certification issue in my argument because the exchange appellee.
So, do you agree with the Black's Law Dictionary definition that I cited earlier, a fact that affects an existing legal relation, especially a legal claim?
Yes, I think that's an accurate definition. Exchange appellee will argue this in more detail, as well as the newly raised issue by the appellants of the that a charter violation requires unanimous vote for settlement. And then finally, the strategic investor defendants will address the practical implications of the settlement.
Well, Mr. Maimon suggested as his alternative argument that there be subclasses. Tell us how you see the allocation proceeding operating under the present structure as opposed to how it would operate if there were subclasses.
Well, I think the intention would be we'd be going back to the chancellor. We would try to create an allocation plan. I think at that point, if there's still disputes among the various class members, the chancellor can determine whether there's a need for subclasses. He indicated that on the record previously at A454. Notably, there has been no request for subclasses prior to the time of the settlement being announced. And indeed, none of the citations that the appellant cite actually have a case where subclasses were provided at that late date. But again, this is a matter that the chancellor has stated his recognition of a potential issue with his ability to deal with that at the time when it arises. Now,
so just like class certification, sometimes until something is settled, you can certify, decertify a class, revisit issues. You're saying here that if the allocation goes forward, the question of whether there should be subclasses is an open issue that could be revisited.
Yes, I think the chancellor indicated, depending on what the facts are in front of him and they're raised to him, he invited people, if they need to, they can approach him to allow their input into the nature of the class and the allocation plan.
So the decision of whether or not to create subclasses, assuming this is a class to be certified, was a discretionary matter. And you're saying there was no abuse of discretion because to the extent there's any issue that may come up, it can be addressed during the allocation stage.
That's correct. And indeed, even this class that's been certified by the chancellor is one that's not so distinct from other classes that have been certified in Delaware cases, where oftentimes there are holders, buyers, sellers. I mean, there's a host of cases, including TriArc, Prodigy, where that very nature of a class has proceeded.
Speaking of the class, what is your response to, I believe it was Mr. Valahira's argument, that the chancellor had basically was required under the teaching of the Prezant case, which is a decision by this court, to make explicit findings that the criteria for certification under Rule 23A had to be made and was not done here?
I disagree. I think it was done here. It's in the record in terms of what the chancellor did from the bench. He noted he had considered all the arguments that had been put before him. He put a record through his transcript. He also put it in the final order. So I disagree.
Well, was there an explicit finding of typicality? And if so, where? And was there an explicit finding of adequacy of representation? And if so, where in the record?
Those are, I believe, at A454 in terms of, in the argument or in the opinion issued by the chancellor from the bench at A450 and the succeeding pages, he touches upon that. The final order is actually at A459. Now, I just want to explain, if I can, the basis of the class definition here. And it's one that arose out of the evolution of the facts and opinions in this case. Most significantly, on December 7, 2006, the court denied defendants' motions to dismiss and took particular note of the centrality of the claim having to do with breach of fiduciary duty due to the violation of the FLEX charter, that is, related parties owning more than 20%. the court even went on to point out that the central remedy in this case was rescission, and particularly noted at A211J. And the significance of that is that we have a dispute here as to whether purchasers after August 16th are properly members of the class. It's argued that that's a cutoff date, whereas our argument is that it's an ongoing injury by the failure of the board to rescind its violation of the charter. And the charter concerned not just the acquisition of the shares, but the ongoing voting and control of the FILEX through the shares held by the related parties. The fact that rescission was such a central element of a potential remedy was further enforced by the court's ruling on May 31st, 2007, where the defendant's motion for summary judgment to have rescission declare an unavailable remedy was issued by the court. Then at the final settlement hearing, the court reiterated that the rescission claim was the heart and soul of the claim. Now, the transfer, the appellant's argument that attempts to cut off the class as of August 16th simply ignores the ongoing nature of this injury, which is both the fact that it's the ongoing control of the strategic investors, as well as a number of other significant chronologic events that occur.
Well, but after that cutoff date in August of 2005, anybody who became a stockholder knew what the ongoing injury was, so basically bought into it, right?
Well, it's not quite that clean at that moment in time, because subsequently there's a tender offer issued on September 22nd, 2005. In that tender offer, there's much greater disclosure as to what the impact of dilution would be upon the...
Okay, so instead of August 2005, it's September 2005, but that's still 2 years earlier than what the current class includes.
Well, and in addition, there's even other events that occur. For instance, we attempt to enjoin the issuance of the warrant shares as late as June of 2006.
My question is it fair to say that someone who buys stock knowing what the alleged wrong is, that it's continuing and that it exists, that person is supposed to get relief as part of a settlement when other people own this stock totally ignorant of this problem?
Well, that's certainly part of the mix of information that we would need to evaluate in terms of the allocation. I mean, I think you have to weigh the different weights of the claims going forward. But I think even in the appellant's arguments where they argue there was a charter violation that's the property of the holders of the shares, even going forward, they've essentially acknowledged that there is some injury to those persons, holders including the transferees. So that's part of the weighting of who was more injured in these events. And I did just want to touch on one other issue that was raised newly by the certification appellants on Sun States. Now, that was an issue that had not been raised either at the Chancery Court or previously in the appellant arguments about the idea of rejecting Sun States. And Sun States is really one of the key cases in this related to this issue as to who's in the class, because by Sun States, it appears that the charter claim does transfer, and those people would have a right to that claim as it transferred across, again, due to the fact that there was an ongoing injury to any Class A shareholders due to the violation of the charter. Now, the problem with the court even considering overturning Sun States is that it would undermine a nationwide plan of under the UCC as to how share transfers affect the rights of shareholders both before and after such sales. I think it even poses a question as to how would somebody enforce a charter violation if you overturned Sun States, the person holding the shares, how would they subsequently enforce shareholder rights of a charter violation? Now, I also want to point out that in the arguments raised here challenging the class, which have been raised principally by by sellers here. Below, there were buyers who also objected, and therefore the proper forum to deal with these questions as to who gets which component of this settlement, I think, again, is more properly in front of the chancellor in terms of allocation, since that would provide them some opportunity to be heard as well, since they are not involved in this argument. Now, in sum, the class definition was congruent with the facts and court opinions of this specific case and was properly certified by the chancellor. Now, I just want to turn very briefly to some arguments made on adequacy of representation. And there's two components to that. One is the class representative and one is counsel. In terms of class representative, Mr. Ginsburg was a holder both at the beginning and all the way through the case here. And in fact, the argument that's being raised here is to a potential dispute between buyers and sellers. He's neither buyer or seller, and indeed that makes him more objective and having no bias from his standpoint. In terms of class counsel, there's some implicit argument that's been made that we somehow are favoring one of the buyers, Susquehanna, and suggesting that there's some special deal between us. There's no record of that, and there's no truth to that. And
thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Your Honor, may it please the Court. I intend to address two main issues here today, the scope of the release and a new argument that was raised for the first time on appeal in the certification appellant's reply brief regarding the alleged need for unanimous stockholder approval to settle a breach of charter claim because it allegedly involves a void act. Time permits, I may also touch upon some of the class certification issues that Mr. Deutsch has already addressed. For all the reasons that we've set forth in our answering brief, we respectfully submit that the Court below did not abuse its discretion in approving the settlement certifying the class, and we respectfully submit that the Chancellor's ruling should be affirmed in all respects. After considering objections from five groups of objectors below, including very lengthy written submissions and oral argument, the Court approved the settlement and finally certified the class, and the Court did not mince words in doing so. It found on the record that it was ineluctably clear that the settlement is fair because it achieves a significant and substantial monetary benefit for the class. The Court further found that the settlement was fairly negotiated and fairly surrenders potential claims in return for a compromise that defendants won't assert defenses that the Court found were extremely strong. The Court held below that the release was broad but still consistent with precedents like Nottingham and Matsushita because the release claims arise out of a common nucleus of operative facts asserted in this complaint. The Court found that it was indisputable that the operative facts included, among other things, demutualization. The Chancellor went on in his ruling to list a number of other operative facts that were part of the case, including whether or not the charter had been violated, and went on to say concluded that those circumstances formed the entire mix of claims that were before the Court in one fashion or another, and that I heard countless arguments about in discovery and motion practice, and that I am confident now are properly encapsulated under Delaware law by the scope of the release in this settlement.
What's your view on its effect on the Feinberg litigation?
Your Honor, I intend to address that, and I will answer that now. The Feinberg versus Benton case has been dismissed. There was a directed verdict entered last week. The parties up there never asserted the release in this case as a defense.
Okay, so hypothetically then, if they had, is the scope of this settlement broad enough to have included that claim, or would that insider trading type of case not have been included?
I doubt that claim would have been included. There is an overlap of facts that are alleged in the case, but it was never asserted as a defense up there, and after the plaintiff put on their case at trial last week, the case was dismissed. Your Honor, in reviewing the settlement, the Court below was required to do certain things. It needed to find that the settlement was in the best interest of the class, in essence, that it was fair, reasonable, adequate. The law in Delaware does not require that the parties be given a trial on the issues. Rather, the Court is required to look into the facts and circumstances on which the claims are based, possible defenses, and exercise a form of business judgment in assessing the overall reasonableness. On appeal, this Court's standard of review is much more limited. That is, for the Court to set aside a settlement which the Court below has found to be fair, This court must find evidence in the record so strongly to the contrary of that conclusion as to amount to an abuse of discretion. That's from Nottingham at page 1102. We respectfully submit that the Chancellor here followed all of the appropriate standards in approving the settlement, did not abuse his discretion in any way, and there is no evidence, let alone strong evidence, in the record to the contrary. The court articulated in detail the basis for his conclusions. He identified the governing standards and found that the release is releases claims that are or matters that are part of the operative facts of the case. And the court
How do you respond to the suggestion that there weren't specific findings, simply conclusions with regard to the requirements of Rule 23 that were put in the order?
Yeah, obviously, Your Honor, I disagree with that. The order itself does make the express findings. What we also had here, we had an oral argument that went on for pages and pages, and the Chancellor, on the record, rejected the very arguments that Mr. Vallejura is making on this appeal with respect to typicality and all of the issues. So did the Chancellor, at the oral argument, tick off each of the things that are in his order? I don't believe that he did on the record, but the totality of the transcript from that argument shows that the arguments were made, considered by the court, and rejected. Moreover, there was a class certification previously in this case. There was full briefing of a class certification motion, and an order was entered back in May of 2006, certifying the class initially.
So your point would be there is no reason for us to remand it to the Chancellor to make those findings because we can see what his conclusions were, look to the transcript, and decide for ourselves whether those conclusions are supported by the record. Is that your point?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct, Your Honor. Your Honors, I want to turn to the voidness issue that Mr. Maimon raised, and I feel it important for me to turn to that now because the appellees in this case never had an opportunity to submit a writing to Your Honors about this issue. This issue was never raised in the court below. If Your Honors look at the transcript sites that Mr. Maimon gave or the record sites, you will not find this argument raised. And it was not raised in the hearing in the Chancellor before the Chancellor with respect to the settlement. It was not raised in their opening brief, and it appeared for the first time in their reply brief. And we submit that it ought to be rejected out of hand for that reason alone. But even if Your Honors go to the merits of that issue, it should be rejected for a host of reasons. First, the allegations of a charter violation here in this case were unadjudicated. There was never a finding below that the charter had been violated. Indeed, this was a hotly contested issue that was going to be the subject of a trial until this settlement occurred on the eve of that trial. If Your Honors look at all of the pretrial briefs that are in the record, this was front and center and was going to be a main theme of the plaintiffs, and it was a main area of defense for the defendants. And indeed, the court below concluded in assessing the settlement that we had extremely strong defenses. The plaintiff barely got by a motion to dismiss. Summary judgment motions were a close call, and there was a real risk the plaintiffs were going to recover nothing on these claims. So indeed, far from a finding of a void act or a charter violation or a void act, we have none of that here. Third, even if this particular charter violation had been proven, which it wasn't, we don't believe that that automatically equates to a finding of a void act. My colleagues cite cases like Star Surgical and Triplex for that proposition. We respectfully submit those cases aren't on point because they deal with either charter violations or statutory violations with respect to the creation of stock. Here, there is no dispute that the stock that was issued in the strategic transactions was, in fact, validly created at the time of demutualization and that they were properly created and they were authorized under the charter. Your Honors, fourth, there's a case directly on point we submitted to Your Honors on Monday, Cohn versus Zarowitz, that rejects this very argument that is being proffered. In that case, this court affirmed then-Vice Chancellor Hartnett's denial of a preliminary injunction and his approval of a class action settlement over the objections of certain preferred shareholders who raised a similar issue to that raised here, namely that in that case the preferred stockholder's supposed contractual right under the charter to vote on a merger and an alleged a breach of the charter could not be abrogated by a proposed class settlement. Vice Chancellor Hartnett denied the injunction and approved a settlement over the objection of that stockholder, holding that because the right of the preferred stockholders to vote was questionable, the right could be compromised just as any other good faith dispute. This court affirmed that ruling and expressly stated, because the preferred stockholders' right to vote was the subject of a genuine good faith dispute, it could be compromised during settlement negotiations. And that's at page 1237 of the Cohn case. We think that that case is the beginning and the end of this argument, but even if it weren't, there is analogous case law under the Waste cases, where Waste, in essence, involves a claim of a void act. This court and the Court of Chancery have never required unanimous stockholder approval to approve settlements of Waste claims, indeed have approved many settlements over objections involving similar claims. Similarly, in Nottingham versus Dana, there the plaintiffs challenged a charter amendment and a recap plan, alleging that it was void because there was not adequate stockholder approval. The court again approved the settlement, including that claim of alleged void act, and this court affirmed. And implicit in the rejection of that objection is the notion that unanimous shareholder approval to settle such a claim is not required. The same is true here. Finally, we believe that the argument they make would make bad policy under Delaware law and is inconsistent with existing policy in Delaware that favors the voluntary settlement of contested issues. The acceptance of this argument would allow for the possibility of a charter claim being leveled, no matter how weak it is, and not allowing a company or directors to the flexibility to try to settle that claim absent getting the complaining stockholders' approval. And we submit that that's just not the law, and it's not a policy that this court should set. Your Honor, I want to turn to the scope of the release. The release in this case is a general release of all claims, and the court below found that it fairly surrenders potential claims, the settlement does. In that regard, we believe the release is entirely consistent with Delaware law. Indeed, the court found it was broad but still consistent with Matsushita and Nottingham. Those cases stand for what I believe is the well-settled proposition that in order to achieve a comprehensive settlement, it's entirely appropriate for a class settlement to release claims beyond those specifically alleged, provided that the released matters arise under the same operative facts, even if those claims were not presented and might not have been presentable. Thus, we believe it's crystal clear that a settlement can prevent class members from attempting to rely on different legal theories. I think it's important, if Your Honors look at Nottingham, what the court said at 1105 is the settlement there included a general release of all claims that were or could have been asserted against the defendants, arising out of matters and transactions referred to in the Dana complaint. That release, we submit, was consistent with this court's prior holding in a case called Ruttman versus Kaminsky, where this court rejected an attack on the scope of a release in a derivative settlement, finding that the release there was in the usual form because it was limited to matters contemplated by the complaints, and that it released the former officer there from any matter related to acts or transactions described in the complaints. Here, demutualization was part of the allegations in this case from day one. It was front and center in the amended complaint, and my colleagues missed the point when they argue that demutualization was not a cause of action or it wasn't a specific claim. What is relevant is that the Chancellor found it indisputable that demutualization was part of the common nucleus of operative facts, and there's no evidence, let alone strong evidence, that that finding was an abuse of discretion.
Well, as I understand your opponent's argument, it's that all of that could be excised out of the complaint, and it's just, in essence, surplusage. Why isn't it surplusage?
Well, obviously, Your Honors, I disagree that it's mere surplusage. The demutualization allegations were the genesis of the claims that are asserted here. And I say that because, one, in demutualization, the exchange charter was amended to increase the amount of authorized stock. It was expressly done, and it's disclosed in the demutualization information memorandum, that it was done for the purpose of allowing the exchange flexibility in considering strategic transactions, just like those at issue here. That fundamentally was the basis for where these claims arose. Indeed, in addition, in demutualization, the charter was amended to add the 20% member ownership restrictions that were also allegedly violated by these transactions. So far from them being just merely background facts, these were critical facts that laid the foundation for these claims. Indeed, my colleagues conceded in their brief below, this is a direct quote, it's at A306 in the record, that the theft of their equity began with the Philex's demutualization and culminated when their shareholdings were diluted by a faithless Philex board. That's the theme in the amended complaint. It's been the theme throughout this case, which was these transactions, starting with demutualization, ending with the strategic transactions, were all perpetrated by an allegedly interested management team out to feather their own nest. And so far from that just being a mere background fact, it was a theme of the case. If Your Honors look at the entirety of the record, the allegations in the amended complaint could not be clearer. It starts at there are various allegations that allege, in our view, serious wrongdoing. Is there a claim for relief specifically? No, but there are claims, for example, that the former seed owners were misled into voting for demutualization. Amended complaint at paragraph 56, which is at B75 through 76, alleges that the seed owners were induced to vote for demutualization by assurances that they would have certain protections, that they were induced to vote in favor of demutualization because, you know, there was going to be these capital funding fees somehow, that they were coerced. It's throughout the complaint, and I believe
I interrupt because you're running out of time, and return to the release question.
Certainly.
There are several pending federal lawsuits, aren't there? One is on appeal, two others are still being litigated. So what's your view on how this release would affect those claims?
Well, Your Honor, if I might, I know I'm eating into Mr. Lockwood's time. Briefly about some of the prior cases regarding demutualization and otherwise. First, the demutualization was attacked by stockholders in Pennsylvania State Court in a case brought by Penmont and Joseph Carapico. They sought a temporary restraining order and an injunction. That was denied. Summary judgment was granted, dismissing demutualization claims. Pennsylvania Supreme Court denied aliquotter. That's in our appendix at B917, but the Carapico v. Philex appeal, at least the order, is at 906 A. 2nd, 1196.
But I'm talking about the federal cases.
Yes, and relatedly, on the heels of that dismissal, Penmont brought a federal case under RICO. That case, too, was dismissed by Judge Brody in the district court and is presently on appeal to the Third Circuit. At this point, as I understand it, the release in this case has not been asserted, but again,
What's your position as to the scope of the release as to those claims?
I believe it arguably would cover some of the allegations in that particular case.
Well, there are several. There's McGowan Investors.
McGowan is nearly a mirror image, and my colleagues conceded in the court below that case arises out of the same operative facts that are at issue in this case. In fact, if you look at the pleadings, they're virtually identical. It's just that the McGowan complaint attempts to plead federal claims, whereas this complaint pled state claims. And that case, too, is on appeal to the Third Circuit right now.
So basically,
that case has been dismissed.
Basically, your position is that the pending federal lawsuits would be subject to dismissal, if not for other reasons than because of the release.
I believe that they arguably would be covered and would be a basis for parties in those cases to assert this release. That would be an issue for those courts ultimately to decide. I think that is clear under Nottingham. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning. It's Paul Lockwood for Merrill Lynch. I'm also speaking for the other strategic investors. Don't have much time, so let me just address first Your Honor's question with respect to other litigation. There is another lawsuit in Philadelphia, the McGowan case, that my client and the other strategic investors are defendants in. That case is a mirror image of this case. It's just brought under the securities laws instead of under Delaware law. And it's certainly, my view, that we would argue in that case that, that this release would cover that case, and it's entirely appropriate. In fact, in the proceedings below, the plaintiff's brief to the chancellor, and this is in the record at A320, states in the Frutcher complaint, which is how they call McGowan, the claims arising from the sales to the six investors are brought under Section 29 of the Securities Exchange Act. The same factual predicates and transactions are at issue in both the Frutcher complaint and the case at Barr. So with respect to that case, when we think that's right in the wheelhouse of Matsushita and should be taken out as a result of this settlement. With respect to the class certification arguments that Mr. Mamone has argued, in essence he's saying that what this court should do is it should cut the class down and carve out from the class persons who have weak rights or weak claims, and that we, the defendants, should be okay with that because then this court will have said they don't have claims, they don't have rights, and they won't be able to sue us. The problem is that if it's approached in that manner, they're not before the court on this appeal. They won't be members of the class, and as a result, they won't arguably be bound by the judgment, and they would be free to sue us elsewhere. And the finality that we negotiated for and that we sought in the settlement would not exist. And the Court of Chancery has recognized that, and that's why in several cases, and we cite numerous of them in our brief, in Prodigy and Triarch in Sun States, the court recognized that the appropriate way to handle it is to take all the claimants who contend that they have rights, weak or strong, put them in the class, and then in the allocation decision determine whether someone gets any proceeds of the settlement or not. And in fact, the suggestion has been made that that's unfair because it would put a lot of pressure on the court to give someone more than a zero. But there are numerous cases in the Court of Chancery in which zero has been awarded. It happened in Resorts. It happened in Sun States. It happened in Triarch, where the court lumped them all together and said, you get something, you get nothing. And that can still happen here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a few points in response. Triarch and Prodigy didn't involve charter violations, and Sun States is the problem here. Sun States is the problem, and as Justice Berger noted, it's creating a situation where stockholders that were not injured and had knowledge of wrongdoing are part of a settlement class and have the possibility of collecting as part of a settlement monies that should be directed to stockholders that were injured. They shouldn't be there at all. They don't have a weak claim. They have no claim, and that's why they shouldn't be there at all.
And you're going to be able to make all of those arguments in the allocation, aren't you?
If we're not successful here, yes, we will make those arguments below. I want to touch on the Cohn v. Crocker National case, which my colleague, Mr. Lafferty, mentioned. It's a 1985 decision of this court that upheld the settlement of claims of charter violations approved by the Court of Chancery. This decision has not been relied upon for this proposition for over 20 years. This decision is different than this action and different than Sun States because it involved monetary relief received solely by preferred stockholders injured by defendant's conduct. In fact, this case supports our view that if you're injured, you should receive the monetary relief, and if you're not injured, you shouldn't receive the monetary relief. In fact, you shouldn't be a member of the class. This decision also did not address the legal issues regarding charter violations presented to this court today. Indeed, the legal issues presented here never were addressed in Cohn. In fact, the Cohn decision was decided strictly on a very limited factual issue. It was an issue to deal with whether preferred stockholders were represented adequately by plaintiff's attorneys during a settlement process. At most, Cohn should hold for the general rule that good faith disputes may be settled, but this case should not be read to hold that a stockholder may be stripped of the right to challenge an alleged charter violation through a class action settlement absent his approval. The bottom line is, our view is, a stockholder has a right to enforce a charter. And that is a claim, and that claim needs to be adjudicated. One stockholder cannot settle that right for another stockholder, in our view.
Are you going to, or perhaps you did and I missed it, your opponent is saying that this was not raised below and we should not consider it.
Well, this was raised in our reply brief in response to their answering brief, because our opening brief asked where's the injury.
In this court or in the Court of Chancery?
I was not involved in the Chancery litigation, and the specific argument wasn't raised, but the theories challenging the scope of the class were raised. And I believe we have the ability to make different arguments based upon the same theories, and that's what we're doing here. So I think Cohn actually supports at least part of our view that there must be an injury, and I think Cohn Also doesn't really apply to the charter violation issue addressed today because these issues were never put before the court in connection with the charter violation. In closing, one thing I'd like to make clear from my client's perspective is that class plaintiff stated that there's rescission is part of the settlement. The bottom line is nothing is being rescinded to remedy the charter violation here. If there is a charter violation, every stockholder, at least every stockholder that was a stockholder at the time of the wrongdoing, has a right to challenge that charter violation, and that stockholder should not be stripped of that right based upon a class action, a non-opt-out class action for damages. And if a stockholder wants to pursue that right, they should have the ability to see if a charter violation actually existed or not. To strip them of that right would overturn 100 years of Delaware law, which says unanimous stockholder approval is required in order for the actions that violate a charter not to be invalidated or therefore void as a matter of law. And my time is up, and I thank Your Honors for your attention.
Thank you, Your Honors. In the brief time I have, I want to just point out that it is our contention that the transcript will not show that the Chancellor addressed each of the Rule 23 requirements. You can go through it. You'll find that I started off the discussion and that the Chancellor did not address each one of those things. And we believe, again, that the Chancellor had to do that before he could get to the merits of the settlement. And his failure to do so requires your honors to go back to the Chancery Court and ask him to put that on the record.
What about the May 2006 order and the briefing that preceded that?
Your Honor, good point. The point that is a preliminary ruling by the court. That is not the final order. It was sent out in the notice to the stockholders that they would have a chance to challenge the class action certification, and that is what we did, Your Honor. We made that clear. We made it in our objections, and then we made it at the hearing, and he had an obligation under Prezant to make that finding, which he did not, Your Honor. With respect to demutualization, Your Honor, I want to make it clear that it is our position that the only individuals that can bring a demutualization claim are the seat owners, not the stockholders, because it was the seat owners that were harmed here. They are the ones that were the owners of this company at the time that the wrongs were alleged. It is after the fact. The stockholders were after the fact, and therefore you can't bring those demutualization claims. Can you bring something? Your Honor, they're crafty lawyers. Maybe they can, maybe they can't. I don't know, Your Honor, but the people that claim.
The claims that are being released are claims by stockholders.
Your Honor, correct? but the two are intertwined.
Correct.
And we don't know whether.
Could you answer my question?
Yes, Your Honor. It is stockholders. Yes, Your Honor.
So if the stockholders are releasing but don't have any claim, what's the harm to your clients?
Your Honor, it is the fact that we don't know how that is going to be applied to in the other courts. We don't know, Your Honor. And we want to make sure that demutualization, which was not an operative fact here, is not part of this settlement. Your Honors, thank you very much. I appreciate your attention to my arguments today.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.